The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I don't experience it as a choice at all. I experience it as a mandate, no different. You can say to the hotels, well, you're choosing to pursue embassy business, pursue some other business. Why do you care that the embassies are not coming to you? You're choosing to have a profit margin. It is intolerable. Think if it was any other form of discrimination, or to tell the ACLU, you're choosing to defend our Constitution. You're choosing to defend that person. It is not a choice like picking what necktie I'm going to wear today. It's a mandate, imperative on all Americans, on all organizations, but above all on Crew, which is dedicated to fighting corruption. And here you have an assault on the most core American legal protection against corruption. It's in the Constitution.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 11th, 2017. One of the odder side effects of electing Donald Trump as president has been a surge of interest in the previously little-known Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which prohibits any person holding any office of profit or trust from accepting any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And ethics experts Norm Eisen and Richard Painter have been leading the charge to hold Trump accountable under the Emoluments Clause for his failure to divest from his businesses after taking office. The two have filed suit against Trump in their capacity as chair and vice chair of the good government group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Benjamin Wittes sat down with Norm to talk through the details of the lawsuit and spell out what all this has to do with national security. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 208. Norm Eisen on the Emoluments Clause.
So let's start with the Emoluments Clause, what it is and why it's in the Constitution and what it has to do with national security.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. The Emoluments Clause is a result of a terror that our founders and our framers of the Constitution held. And, you know, it was a scary world in which this fledgling United States was established. So they had a lot of fears, none greater than the fear that a foreign sovereign, as was common in those days, would use cash or other treasure to distort the judgment of American political leaders, above all the president himself.
And was this, like, was there an incident that gave rise to this? I mean, it always struck me as a sort of veiled reference to Benedict Arnold or,
well,
you know,
there's other laws. No, it's really, it's a good question. My friend and co-counsel in our litigation against President Trump on his emoluments violation, Zephyr Teachout, has written a whole book detailing the incidents that set off this fear of foreign cash and benefits, so-called emoluments of any kind, whatever they put in there. It's a very sweeping capture of any kind of valuable benefit. And probably the practice, the common practice of kings buying off neighboring sovereigns was the greatest worry. that had been prevalent. As you know, some of the European kings would spend themselves deep into debt. It had been a prevalent practice. It was horrifying, as you can imagine, to the British thinkers, liberal thinkers, liberal in the European continental sense, who so influenced the American founders and framers. So that was probably the practice. Then there were smaller cases, the famous diamond-encrusted snuff box, which the French king gave to Benjamin Franklin. Zephyr has a whole chapter about that in her book. So it was those kinds of fears. And the feeling, and this is germane to the conduct of Vladimir Putin today. The feeling was that you'd have somebody, some say the president is much poorer than he claims to be.
He's a lot of loaded, people are saying it.
Loaded with debt would make him susceptible to, there's probably no surer way to get him to call out the pod by name than us making those, raising those questions, which have been raised by others. I won't say that I know because I don't have his tax returns. I intend to get them in discovery if we make it to discovery.
Well, we're going to come to that point in a minute.
So at any rate, the Putin angle was exactly what they were worried about, that you'd have somebody who needed foreign support. And of course, Trump's sons have said that Russian dollars and business very important to them. And Trump denies it. There's a conflict in the record. That's one of the reasons we want his records. That's just what the framers were worried about. So their anxiety about foreign influence is no less profound today than 1789.
Okay. So let's start by, I mean, you've been become oddly, we've known each other for years, and if I had said which among my colleagues people are whose my kids went to school with their kids, you know, is going to become a media celebrity in the months leading up to the inauguration of Donald Trump. I confess, Norm, your name would not have been at the top of my list.
Bottom of the list. No, it would have been at the bottom of my list, too.
So let's back up and talk about a little bit about the work that you and Richard Painter have been doing. How you came together on this ethics stuff, and to what extent you think about the ethics stuff as a sort of, pardon me if this sounds dismissive, good government politics domestically, and to what extent it's, you know, something deeper than that that we should be thinking about in the national security sphere. Not that ethics is unimportant in and of itself, of course, but it's not something we typically think about on Lawfare or the Lawfare podcast.
Well, you do think about it. You just don't realize that what you're thinking about is ethics. Because one of the issues that has animated Lawfare's incredible readership, it's not just quantity, but it's quality. You know, serious people who work in the overlap of national security and law all read Lawfare. One of the issues that has animated the stuff you've covered, whether it's Guantanamo, torture, limits of executive power, the drone wars, all of those have profound ethics dimensions to them. When I was in the White House, I had the privilege of not doing ethics narrowly, but doing ethics very broadly and sitting at the table in substantive conversations and contributing from a policy perspective. And President Obama wanted that. So you would be amazed at some of the conversations I was a part of, and some of them I can't talk about. I don't know if I'll ever be able to talk about them. So what's happened, though, what's different, and what's happened because of Donald Trump is that these ethics issues, which used to lie below the surface, have submerged, have exploded on to the above the surface, the in full public display, really because of Donald Trump's disdain as a candidate and now as a president for ethics, including the little-known field of constitutional ethics. When I was ambassador, I would always talk about the values that underlay our Constitution. That's what I felt when I took my oath to defend and protect. So that's what's happened, and constitutional ethicists are in great demand, and there ain't many of us.
All right, so let's talk about you and Richard have struck up this most unlikely, like, yes. Felix and Oscar duo.
Exactly.
You were President Obama's ethics guru before you went to the Czech Republic as ambassador. Richard was an ethics lawyer in the Bush White House. How did you guys come together on this stuff, and how much daylight is there between the two of you on the work that you're doing now?
Painter and I first got to know him by reputation, because when I arrived in the White House, one of the things you do as a guru is, you know, to read the sacred Sanskrit texts. And there's a big body of ethics law. I really think of it as either presidential law or the law of the White House. It's another niche, like constitutional ethics, that is little explored. It's a very small niche. There's only room enough, really, for two of us who've made a life's work of it. And Richard was the first, and I discovered him through his memos and his writings, which I thought were good at the time. I'm like, wow, this guy put in, he came in later when there were issues, and issues had to be dealt with in the Bush administration, and he put in some good, tough rules. He had some very strong decisions on, for example, on how he made Hank Paulson dispose of his assets when he came in, cost Paulson millions of bucks. I admired that. So I knew him first through his works. And then I did my White House thing. I went off to Prague. I came back, and I started getting invited to speak on these issues. And Painter would always be there because it's such a small niche. You know, there'd be some larger panel on whatever, and then say, okay, now for a Democratic and Republican perspective. And I got along with the guy from the get-go. He has a very dry sense of humor. I mean, you know, if he's the two of us are really a yin and yang. I like to joke and kid too, but maybe I have a slightly more urban, coastal sensibility. Nobody can ever believe I'm from L.A., Ben. They always think I'm from New York. Painter has a heartland sensibility. The guy looks like John Wayne. Okay, so he's, you know, I really think that's been part of the success. They like to book us on TV because we act different, we sound different, we look different, right. We're different parties, but we agree on almost everything. And that's the amazing thing when you get down to the nitty gritty. And it's not just me and Painter. I wrote an op-ed on swamp draining with Peter Schweizer. Okay, I was a strong Clinton supporter, though I did speak out about ethics issues where I saw things differently from time to time. Ethics, these technical issues really have no party. And you see broad alignment. If you look at some of the former Republican who's, we did these letters warning Trump that he, you know, was making a mistake. Former Republican governors, members of Congress, and, you know, the Tea Partiers. This is not a complicated question. If we ever get to the merits, the constitutional merits in this case or future cases, on the emoluments, it's not a hard question.
Okay, so we're going to come to the merits in a minute, but let's start with the threshold question. What is your best case for standing, and why don't you need somebody who can actually say, I didn't get some business because it went to the Trump Hotel or something, which is, you know, an emolument to the president that's unlawful.
I'm channeling right now what it's like. I miss it to be in court. I used to do this every day. Literally, I was in court almost every day. Motions, pretrial, trials. I would try a lot of cases. And that just feels like the good opening question from the judge.
All right.
It reminds me of that oral argument
counsel,
I listened.
Counsel, we have a threshold standing issue here.
And I'm sure that will be the first question. And I have to say it also reminds me of that fascinating oral argument, telephonic oral argument on the Muslim ban EO that the Ninth Circuit just this week conducted. And the answer to your question, Your Honor, the answer to your question is that the Supreme Court has long held, it's established in the Havens Realty case, that when there's an outrageous constitutional violation or other violation of law, and we have that here, Your Honor, if you'll let me get to the merits, I will. This is not a closed question in President Trump's conduct. When you have that kind of a violation of the rule of law, and an organization, in Havens Realty was a community development organization, had to divert from its purpose, here its crew, there the purpose was community development, they had to switch to fight racial discrimination. Here we've had to switch from all the usual things we do at crew, to deal with Trump's unconstitutional behavior. That's an injury. The fact that I can't go to Congress and talk to them about improving their lobbying laws, that I can't spend as much time as I want to on the executive branch ethics, that I can't talk to the public about the need for campaign finance reform.
But can't,
that's a harm.
But can't a plaintiff always say that?
No.
So what's the limiting principle here?
Why can't anything
that you think is outrageously unconstitutional, why can't you use that to merge the merits in with the standing inquiry in any case? You just say, look, I've had to divert my resources to file this litigation.
Very good question. The Supreme Court and a series of other courts, and this is not just the Supreme Court. This is also the Second Circuit. They've done it again and again. The Southern District of New York, where our cases. They've applied this in a way that actually is a very narrow set of gates. Number one, you have to be a pre-existing organization. Number two, you need to be able to allege, as we've alleged in the complaint, this pattern of conduct. We can show what we were doing. Three, well established. Nobody's going to question when I describe what the functions are of crew. And four, you need to be able to show the diversion to deal with the misconduct. I don't think that opens that wide a gate. And that is what the Supreme Court has held. That is what the Second Circuit has held. And that is why we have standing. And one other point on this. Somebody has to have standing to challenge this. There's a core problem. That's why the Supreme Court wants organizations to be able to step forward. It's logical that a group would be able to do it. It would be nonsensical if we had a grotesque, open, and notorious violation of the Constitution. And the only ones who could come forward is a hotel that would be crushed by the force this president has put the bully in bully pulpit. Look at what he did today. Your Honor, may I please finish? Look at what he did today in the Nordstrom's tweet, where he so wrongly attacked a competitor business, unfair competition in his treatment of Nordstrom's. He's trying to help a family business of his daughter where he's got family financial ties. If we had his taxes, we probably could show he's invested in his daughter's business. It's outrageous. It shouldn't be that businesses have to destroy themselves and open themselves to retaliation. They can come too. and we're talking to them. But you can see why it's very anxiety provoking for them to be the only ones who carry this burden. Forgive me for going on, Your Honor. I feel very strongly about it, and I won't do this with an actual judge.
Okay, so let's turn to the merits.
Did I persuade you?
So I would feel better about your standing chances if there were a plaintiff whose injury could not be said by a judge to be self-inflicted. And I worry that the reaction of a court to this standing claim is going to be, you didn't have to spend your time on this. You chose to spend your time on this. And that's not an injury imposed on you by the illegality of the president. It's or the alleged illegality in the complaint. It's an injury that reflects your choices of time and energy expenditure.
Well, but that choice argument can always be made. Think about how it would feel if in the racial discrimination case that launched the organizational doctrine of Havens Realty. You have people, you have the organization is dealing with people who cannot get their housing because of racial discrimination. And you're going to say, and nobody else is stepping forward to litigate. And the other people who might do it are scared to litigate. And you're going to say to the organization that's helping those people, oh, you're choosing? I'll tell you, I don't experience it as a choice at all. I experience it as a mandate, no different. You can say to the hotels, well, you're choosing to pursue embassy business. Pursue some other business.
I see.
Why do you care that the embassies are not coming to you? You're choosing to have a profit margin. It is intolerable. I think the founders would be horrified at you, especially you, Ben Wittes, of all people, saying, think if it was any other form of discrimination, you're choosing, or to tell the ACLU, you're choosing to defend our Constitution. You're choosing to defend that person. It is not a choice like picking what necktie I'm going to wear today. It's a mandate, imperative on all Americans, on all organizations, but above all on CREW, which is dedicated to fighting corruption. And here you have an assault, an unprecedented, unexpected assault on the most core American legal protection against corruption. It's in the Constitution. That is not a choice like what kind of specialty coffee I want at the Starbucks. It is a mandate.
All right. So let's talk about that.
And I have more to say as well, but I know we'll have to continue that in a future podcast.
Let's talk about that core requirement. What is the fundamental requirements of the Emoluments Clause? What's the parameters of reasonable debate about it? And why are you confident that, assuming you reach the merits of this, that you win?
Well, I'm confident because all of the streams of constitutional interpretation, originalism, textualism, modern efforts, which I happen to agree with, to understand the Constitution not only from its text, but also from its purpose and structure. All of those streams of constitutional understanding make it very clear that the Constitution forbids presidents from taking cash or other benefits, things having a value of any kind, whatever. I'm not, by the way, inserting my words of any kind, whatever. That is in the text of the Foreign Emoluments Clause after a list of things. So they start with gifts. Then the next item in the list is emoluments. I understand that as a counter pose to gifts. So you have things that are given and you have things that are earned, right? So this notion, the farcical notion that Trump's lawyers have advanced that he will, in his hotels only, separate out somehow magically, I don't even know how you do this, the profits, but keep the rest, is inimical to the plain meaning of the Constitution today as when it was written, to long practice, including a series of OLC memos, which requires segregation because of this broad of any kind, whatever, segregation of all revenues, not just profits. Never mind the fact that he's why in his hotels and not on his golf courses or his office buildings or his loans or his permits or his trademarks. It's nonsense. I think it's a slam dunk.
Okay, so let's talk through that. Gifts are separately banned. So an emolument is something other than a gift, right? We have a principle that we give each word meaning.
Sometimes there's overlap. So, but I would say an emolument, I understand an emolument to be, I do read it in context with gifts, and I understand it to mean essentially gifts or anything else of value that is not a gift. And then they move to another category, which is titles of nobility. And, you know, as a former ambassador, I can tell you it's very attractive. That's the one title you get to keep in American right. life. And I can tell you that that point was not lost on anybody who attended ambassador school with me. So, you know, they go through a shopping list.
Okay. So a few questions about why aspects of Trump's holdings do not ameliorate the emoluments clause.
Yes.
So first of all, what's wrong with the argument that foreign business is sufficiently foreign heads of state or governments is sufficiently de minimis? Why is it the Trump Hotel's problem if they make a service available to the general public? And, you know, the foreign ministry of Bahrain happens to sign up on Expedia for the Trump Hotel rather than the Four Seasons. Surely that is not a problem of constitutional magnitude. Why doesn't that ameliorate it? That it's, you know, it's just it's a service open for general business.
Two reasons. One is these are not de minimis. When you book a big National Day event in a hotel, it's tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars. When you have a foreign leader coming to stay with all of his entourage, his assistants, his security, his media, it can be six figures or more, depending on how long the stay is, can go into the seven figures. So these are large sums, and they're very porous sums, which are rife with opportunities to slip in extra things of value. That's the whole thing that they framers were worried about. So where look at this purported distinction in the hotels between profits and nonprofits. How are you going to gauge what is a profit? What are you going to include? How are you going to keep track of it? How do you know it's a foreign profit? What if the person shows up, the ambassador says, oh, I won't use my diplomatic passport. I'm going to use my personal passport to book this event. I mean, there's so many opportunities to cheat. The founders and the framers wanted emoluments of any kind, whatever, any sort. You know, the word emolument actually comes from grinding. And they wanted any kind, anything that's related, not just presents, but any kind of revenue that's related to work of any kind, any earned revenue, if you will, is supposed to be captured by this. The use of gifts and emoluments and the words of any kind, whatever, are intended to capture the universe of cash that can, or benefits that can hit a president. This would never, now, you can go to Congress and ask for permission. There's a safety valve for this, right? There's been no sign of that. And even though Congress is controlled by Trump's own party, they don't want any part of this because they know the swamp gas is filling the room and it's just going to take one spark of scandal to blow the situation up. Congress doesn't want any part of that.
Okay, so next question. What, and you've sort of answered this already, but when the president's lawyers say the emoluments clause was about gratuities, was about baubles and bribes. It was never about, you know, services exchanged for actual market value of those services. What I hear you saying is that that's, as a historical matter, incorrect.
It's incorrect. The literature is replete with refutations. There's been a very good paper by Joshua Matz. There's been another that he wrote with Larry Tribe. Recently, there's been other stuff on this subject, and it's just not right.
Okay, so is there any kind of de minimis exception to the emoluments clause? I mean, if you have a giant company that does a huge amount of business all over the place and a tiny, tiny bit of it incidentally happens to be with a foreign government, is that of concern, or is it only when it rises to a certain level?
We wouldn't be litigating this if we were talking about de minimis exceptions. The Constitution does say of any kind whatever, and the folks have gotten in trouble for what you might describe as relatively de minimis emoluments. There is a gift limitation, slightly over $300. Anything above that gift a foreign government provides would technically be a violation. But in the case of the president, we're talking about massive violations, not de minimis ones.
All right. And what about the corporate form? So I look at this and I say the whole purpose of a corporation is that it has a personhood independent of the individual owners. So my question is the Trump Organization Donald Trump? And secondly, what if Donald Trump owned one share of the Trump Organization? How much, what do you have to do before the corporate form in fact starts to mitigate the problem?
You have to do a lot more than Donald Trump has done here. Of course, there is a concept in American law of corporate separation, but Donald Trump has elected to operate his business in such a way that he keeps personal control over every aspect of the Trump Organization. He's historically so. The structure of it personal ownership. So I think that we're not talking about Donald Trump, like with the de minimis, we're not talking about him owning one share in General Motors and General Motors receiving an emolument. These are an interlocking set of LLCs and LLPs where he often has majority ownership that are 100% identified with him. So I think in the debate about the case, the corporate gurus recognize that the corporate form issues, because of the choices that Donald Trump has made, are unlikely to detain us. These emoluments are effectively, because he's hung on to ownership. Remember, Ben, he's still the owner of these entities. These emoluments are effectively going right into his wallet. He's basically said to his kids, boys, hold on to my wallet, but everything that is in it still belongs to me.
So you wouldn't take the view that if he was merely a rich guy who owned a lot of individual stocks rather than putting them in that any business that, let's say he owned, you know, 100,000 shares of Microsoft, that any business that Microsoft might do with a foreign government is a problem? Or would you take that view?
There are a series of tests. I don't think that there's a serious issue with respect to his interlocking LLCs and LLPs and these companies where sometimes he'll have 90%, 95%, 99% ownership of the entity. There are a series of tests, however, for more serious challenges. For example, there's a control test where once you accumulate 5% of the shares of a company, you're deemed to be a controlling entity in certain respects under securities law. There are other control tests that are lower and higher for other purposes. But again, we're far from those standards in this case.
So what I hear you saying really is that there are edge cases that may be very hard, but this is, in your opinion, just so far over the line that you actually don't need to be able to, you don't need to define the specific standard that would govern a hard case.
I'm certain we're going to have a conversation about, among many other issues, and the case presents a lot of issues of first impression. I won't be surprised at all if we end up in the Supreme Court, maybe more than once, as we litigate threshold issues up, go back down, perhaps litigate merits issues up. But this is not going to be one of them. This is an issue that we'll address. The corporate experts are not unduly detained because of the nature of Donald Trump's ownership. I would summarize the case by saying when you look at the law, we have a surprisingly strong standing argument, I think a winning standing case in the Second Circuit, given the way it has interpreted the Havens Realty Doctrine. And when you get past the threshold hurdle of standing, we have a layup, slam dunk, nothing but net, emoluments clause merits case. And I dare say the strength of the constitutional violations here, not to mention profound policy concerns that underlie them, put the wind in our sails a little bit on the procedural questions.
One last question, and then I'll let you go. What relief are you asking for? So a court finds you have standing, and they find that the president has been in violation of the Emoluments Clause since day one. What do they do about it? They're not – the House Judiciary Committee could impeach him about it, but what remedies does a court have here?
When we get to the remedies phase, in the first instance, the court will likely ask both sides to submit orders describing the relief to be requested in the court's order. That'll have some nuances to it, but in essence, it's pretty simple. The court, we will ask, to order Donald Trump to stop accepting foreign emoluments in violation of the Constitution. And then Donald Trump will need to go back and think about how he's going to comply with that court order. And then, you know, we may have additional briefing, additional discovery even about whether or not it's being complied with. So that's not a conceptually challenging order to write. Donald Trump, fire your emoluments. Emoluments is an order, Donald Trump. Trump, tell your emoluments, you're fired. Okay? And then he needs to figure out the exact terms of the separation, how he'll step away from the emoluments. I'll preview that by saying, and this really is where the whole debate started with myself and Painter, bipartisan way, calling for the president, then candidate Trump, to make a clean break. He'll need to hand over his ownership interest to a trustee to liquidate, which is what he should have done in the first place, what every president of both parties has done with far fewer constitutional and legal conflicts and issues than Donald Trump has. Hand it over to the trustee, let the trustee figure out how to liquidate it, make a clean legal break. I think it's okay to take some time to do that. That's how it's going to play out when it comes to remedies.
Norm Eisen, thanks so much for joining us.
Ben, always a pleasure.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks, especially Twitter. And thanks for listening.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.